Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone.
Hi,
you want to have some fun?
Yeah, we're going to have fun.
Okay, are you ready? Sing along now.
My name is Stanley Bookman, and I come from the world of ink. I live in a town called Storyville that's closer than you think. Just hop online and you will find my online world of fun. There's stories, poems, and features on everything under the sun. Just type in Stories for Children magazine at .org to the end. Come join me in reading adventures, we're sure to become good friends. So come to the world of ink with me, we'll share a story or two. We'll go all over the world, you'll see, we'll have fun the whole day through.
Follow me to the world of ink.
We're not going to have somebody do the opening. Okay, this is me.
No, senior. I can do it. Hi,
okay,
everybody.
Well, I was like, oh, I thought you guys were going to do the opening.
Yep, I meant to double check, and I was enthralled. But anyways, welcome to the Stories for Children show at BTR's World of Ink Network. We hope you'll call in later and chat with our host, Irene Roth, and myself, Chris Quinn Christofferson. Before you wonder where V.S. Grenier is, she's changing roles for today's show, and she is our very special guest. It's 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on June 6th. As always, you can listen live at blogtalkradio.com/worldofinknetwork, or you can listen to it on demand at any time you'd like at the same address or on iTunes. So, hello, everyone. It's great to have you here, and again, we are so excited to have V.S. Grenier, Chief Editor and Founder of Stories for Children Publishing, as our guest this afternoon. Today, Virginia is wearing her published author hat, and we will be talking about her delightful book, Babysitting Sugar Paw. My co-host is Irene Roth, Stories for Children nonfiction assistant editor and book reviewer. Hello, ladies.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Kind of
so
different, Virginia, quizzing you.
I know. It's why when I got quiet after the viewers, I was like, okay, maybe.
It'll be kind of strange.
See, we're not used to this change.
right. Well, I had it out, and then I was thinking, well, I didn't double check with her, so I was just going to wait to see if you jumped in or if I should. So, obviously, I should have.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It's okay.
No, that's okay.
I know. I told Irene that I would do the end, so I didn't think about the beginning.
I guess that's why I thought, well, maybe she's going to do the beginning, too, and then I didn't double check. So my fault, but that's okay.
Yeah.
We'll just jump right in. Virginia, can you give us some background on how Babysitting Sugar Paw came to be? Is it based on a real experience? I'm sure you've got that question before.
Oh, yeah. I've actually been asked that quite a few times. Okay, so we're being flipped around on my own show. That's all the questions lately on the network. It's kind of, there's actually two background stories to it. Randy Lynn Marvos actually on her blog earlier this week during the tour had me write a guest post about this, and she was shocked because most people think, because usually I only share the one story, and lately I've been kind of sharing the two stories about the book, because when I wrote the story, I was actually taking the Institute of Children's Literature How to Write for Children and Teens course, and I was taking the course more for like a hobby kind of thing, never thought I was going to get into writing at all, so that's basically kind of what got me to where I am now. That was point A of my journey. And at the beginning of the course, they have a picture. I think it's the first or second lesson in their basic writing course, where they have like three pictures, and you're supposed to pick from the three pictures and write a story. And there's a picture of these bears, and they're in a bathroom, and they're basically, like, a couple of them are in the tub taking a bath, some of them are climbing, like, the walls and up to the windowsill, you know, just basically how you kind of fit your kids acting like monkeys in your house.
Sure.
Kind of picture. And so I looked at it, and it instantly, the character Sugar Paw came into my mind, because I loved the bears, and I could see, and then at the same time as I was visualizing Sugar Paw, I could visualize him, you know, basically, like any kid when they take a bubble bath, getting water all over the bathroom. and making a huge mess. And of course, I could see like this horrified look of like a mom. It was like, oh my gosh. And not just like they made a mess of the bathroom, like where they took like, you know, like how a lot of moms usually, just because they need to soak every so often from the hectic day of raising children. They usually have like a favorite bath salt or bubble bath, you know, in their bathroom. And I used to work for a company called L'Occitane, which is a French bath and body company. And that was like my biggest selling point to actually the women is, I tell them, you know, oh, you know, when you've had a long day at work or if they're a stay-at-home mom or kids or whatever, and I'd always build a tag on bubble bath and bath salt on all myself. So that was coming into my mind, and why the mom had the horrified look was because basically the kid took and dumped, like, all of their favorite, most expensive, you know, bubble bath or bath salt into the bath, and then now are making a huge mess on top of it. This is like kind of like the image that was climbing in my mind. And then as I started working on this story, I started kind of thinking about how I was as a kid. And because I didn't babysit other people's kids. I absolutely, as a teenager, did not like other people's children. So my mom never thought I was going to have kids. It's true, I didn't. So my mom never thought I was going to have kids, and she worried if I ever did what was going to happen. Because I had like this hatred of kids. Growing
well,
up,
most
teenage girls like, oh, cute baby, and the baby looking, I'm like, oh, it's staring at me. I know, here I write for children, right? I know everybody's like, oh my gosh, but no, it's true. I just didn't. So when I was growing up, I never babysat. But I was babysat a lot because my parents, by the time I was 10 years old, were divorced. So with a single mom, and this actually worked full time, and she'd get, you know, have to go away for meetings sometimes at night and stuff. I'd have to be left with a babysitter, and I hated it. And so I wasn't very nice. I wasn't happy because my parents were divorced, and then I was being stuck with all these like people I didn't know. So I was an absolute horrific kid to babysit. So as I'm writing the story and how awful kids are, I started drawing upon some of like the really nasty stuff I used to do to my babysitter. Yeah, I know. I wasn't nice. Yeah, I was really bad. Anyway, so the story came, you know, from two different areas. It came from, like I said, it first started from the picture from the assignment at ICL, and then, of course, my experience. So it didn't start as a picture book. It actually was a short story assignment, so it was a lot longer. Usually, like a typical picture book manuscript can be anywhere from like one, you know, sheet of typed paper, and it can be if it's a picture storybook, it can be up to five, but usually a shorter one is, you know, maybe three, but it's usually one to two pages long typed.
Yeah, right.
And so the short story was actually like five pages typed because it's double spaced and everything. And it had actually been published as a short story on a Story Box Library, I think is what the online, it was back in 2006, so forgive me, I don't remember, it's been 4 years, no, 5 years.
Sure.
So, I think it was like Storybox Library, I think it was the literary online website that published it as the short story version, and it was actually called The Best Babysitter in Town, and it was actually through the babysitter Bonnie Whisker's point of view, originally, and Kevin Collier, who did the illustration for the picture book, actually did the illustration for the short story. And he really liked it. He's like, you know, you could actually rewrite this and make it a picture book.
Oh, really?
I ho-hummed about it. Yeah,
I
ho-hummed about
that.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I kind of ho-hummed about it for a while. Wasn't sure. Toyed with it. Did, you know, the whole mock-up to shorten it down and did my, you know, chicken scratch kind of drawing. Yeah, I draw stick people. Yeah, I do. And I can illustrate. I can't illustrate, kind of, but typically when I'm just, yeah, it's usually stick people. And so I had my stick bears and stuff and rabbit and kind of illustrate it. And I threw it back at Kevin and said, well, what do you think? And he, at that time, had done quite a few picture books for people. And some of the picture books he had illustrated had won some awards. And he had just recently gotten married to his wife, I think it's Kristen. And they just gotten married, and they had done a few picture books together, and she was getting into being an editor a freelance editor for picture books. And so he's like, well, why don't you have my wife look it over? And so she ended up trimming it down even more for me. And I really tightened it up a lot more, because it's hard when it's your own work to tighten it up.
Sure.
It really is the... I get that question all the time. Oh, well, you're an editor, so you probably don't have to worry about having your work edited. I'm like, are you kidding me? I don't see my errors. That's, you know, don't even, it's like that for any writer. You never see where something can be shorter or where you've made a typo, because in your mind, you already know the story, so you kind of just skim it. You don't really analyze it like you need to.
Right, yeah. You know what it's supposed to say, so you read that in your mind.
Exactly. So she trimmed it up, got rid of a lot of those, you know, like weedy words like that, saying that too much or and, or, you know, words you don't really need, weak modifiers, that kind of stuff. And really liked where it was. So I work for Halo. And we said that Yumina, who's going to actually be on the show with us this coming Thursday, kept asking me, because I'm her chief editor, well, when are you going to, you know, do a book with us? When are you going to do a book with us? So I threw the manuscript thinking, okay, she's going to reject it. And I know once she rejects it, I shouldn't even try and do this.
Oh.
And she loved it. She loved it. And I was like, really, you know, because this was a short story. And
yeah.
So that's kind of how the book came about. I mean, that's kind of the whole backstory of Babysitting Sugar Paw. And, no, I never threw a book in a trash can like Sugar Paw does, but I was notorious that when I had to go do stuff and I didn't want to, I would play limp body like Sugar Paw does in the book, where my baby sister literally have to drag my lifeless body to wherever I needed to be in the house, like to get dressed for bed or something. Yeah, I did that kind of stuff.
Oh, I think it gives a good message, doesn't it, for readers, especially for little kids who hate to be babysat. They just sort of hate the whole idea because they're kind of scared, and they might even be unhappy that they're going to be cared for by strangers. And this book, I think, will really open up the discussion. Like, you know, the parents can talk to the children about this whole issue, you know, because a lot of times kids don't want to talk about this, do they?
Right.
No, they don't, and that's the biggest thing, because, I mean, by the time, when I was working on you know, even the short story version, it was right after I had my second child, my daughter, and that was the whole reason why I even quit working in fashion, and, you know, I was a fashion buyer. I mean, I had worked for companies like Bridges in Hollywood, Hot Topic.
Wow.
I actually helped them open their first, like, 5 to 10 Torrid stores, which is their plus-size division of Hot Topic, Inc. The last company I worked for was Brighton Collectibles, and I was one of the two top buyers there. So, but I had a son who was in private school, and then after that, he would go, it wasn't daycare. He was actually, like, in an after-school kind of camp because he was in the older elementary ages at that time. But I really hated the fact that I only had usually about 3 to 4 hours a day when we got home from work. And we lived, of course, out in L.A., so we have to factor in the fact that, you know, I spent an hour in L.A. traffic to and from work. Yeah, so two hours of my day. So I worked in I didn't work an eight-hour. I worked like a 10 to 11-hour because I was at work for 8 to 9 hours, and then I had an hour commute, and it, you know, there and back. So it ate up a lot of our time. And so when I got pregnant with our second daughter, it was the whole, do we really want to have our child raised in daycare? And the reason why it came up is I hated watching my son go through that. And I remember going through that, you know, with my mom, like I said, being a single parent. And I was really lucky that eventually we moved closer to her mother, and so I had my grandma and my grandpa Bennett, who, you know, used to pick me up from school, and I have an uncle who's 2 years older than me, so we kind of grew up more like brother and sister because of it, because I spent a lot of time with him and after our house, and I was fortunate. But then as I got, you know, older into high school, I was a latchkey kid, and it's hard on kids, and I remember my mom kind of trying to talk to me about it, and I remember, you know, even asking my son when he was in private school and in the daycare camps and stuff, and oh, you know, it's fine, Mom. But what really struck us, and the reality of how much it really affects kids, and why I focused on the book and writing it the way I did, about, you know, because it is about friendship, it's about trust, it's about honesty, but it was also a gateway book, like you said, Irene, for trying to talk to the kids, because there was one time I had a meeting and I could not, and I was fortunate that where I worked in since I worked at Brighton, I worked in City of Industry. And my son was at a private school that also offered the after-school camp right in Covina. So it's about, they're probably about 30 minutes away, factoring in street and some freeway traffic to get to him. But I couldn't get to him. Well, my husband worked all the way out in the Redlands area, which is a good hour. And the 10 freeway, anybody who's listening or has ever been to L.A. knows that the 10 freeway in L.A. and the 5 freeway in L.A. are probably the two worst freeways to have to commute on. And that's the freeway my husband and I came on. He had to commute on the 10. And then he transitioned to the 210 because we lived up in the foothills up in Laverne. So for him to get to our son, it was another 20 minutes past our house in Laverne. And so he was like, don't worry about it. You know, I'll get Dominic. You know, you go ahead and do your meeting. And there was this huge, because you have to when you come into where we were at. It's right on the borderline of San Gabriel Valley and San Bernardino. And it's the Montclair Plaza is right off the 10 right there in that transition. And it's also like right where the LA Fairgrounds, you know, where the fairgrounds are for LA County. And it gets ballin' up right there because there's like, two freeways that dump and transition off the 10 and stuff. So there's a lot of semis. So there's always accidents because there's a lot of traffic to the Montclair Plaza. And there's a huge accident. And he got stuck. Now, he wasn't in it, luckily, but he was trapped and couldn't go anywhere. Even this is like a five-lane freeway. You can't go anywhere. It was bottlenecked because of major accidents. So he ended up showing up like a half an hour late to getting our son. And so he's like apologizing to the people, you know, and Dominic's sitting in the office, and he looked at him, he's like, hey, kid, it's okay, you know, your mom and I always told you, we always be here to get you. He's like, that's okay, I just figured something happened to you if you were dead, and that, you know, Grandma or Papa would come get me eventually. And I just oh my gosh. You know, when your kid's thinking this, when they're in daycare, that, you know, my mom may not show up or my dad may not show up one day, and this is just the reality of life. I realized, oh, this is sad. Parents really need to have something where they can talk to their kids. Because kids don't tell you what's going through. I mean, we had no idea until that day how he really felt being there.
Right,
and that's why when we had our second child, that's exactly why I quit, you know, when we moved out of California, we moved out to Southern Utah. Because it was lower cost of living, I could stay home, and my husband could totally support us. Because there was just, I wasn't going to do that to my kids anymore. You know, I raised it to one for, you know, 8 years. I wasn't going to do it to a second one, and I wasn't going to have my son spend the next half of his life like that.
Sure.
So, yeah, so it's true. And I think, you know, with kids and what parents don't understand, it's not so much that mom and dad are leaving the house and that they're with, like, a complete stranger. It's, what happens if they don't come back and now I'm with this person?
Mm-hmm.
Or what happens if this person does something, you know, to me, you know? All that fear goes through them, you know, mom and dad aren't here to protect me. I mean, that's really what they're thinking. It's the fact that mom and dad aren't there to protect them, that something bad happens, be it to their parents or to them, you know, they have no, even though there's this babysitter here and they're supposed to be this trusting adult, they don't feel like they really have the same security as they do with their parents. And that's really what the bottom line is with Sugar Pond. I mean, it's not that he feels like his parents are completely abandoning him, but it's like it is that feeling, you know. Like, are you going to come back? You know, what happens if something bad happens? What happens, you know, if the house burns? I mean, who knows what's going through through his head? But you know, the house burns down, someone breaks in, you don't make it home, you know, whatever. It's scary. It really is for kids. But then for the babysitters, it's the flip side of, you know, they don't really. You know, with Bunny Whiskers, when you read the story, I mean, for her, you know,
right.
You don't know the kids' routine. You don't know what they like and what they don't like. I know with my youngest, my baby, she has a very particular way of going to bed. And if you don't put her to bed the right way, well, you're not going to get her to sleep. And
basically,
demon baby comes out, and it's not fun. And so we don't... No, I'm serious. My husband can't even get her down. It's that bad.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really. I can, and my son can, and my parents can, and so I don't leave her with anybody if we're going to be out at night and she's going to have to go down for bed unless Dominic's either here with them, or my parents come over and watch her, because it's just, it'll be a nightmare.
Right.
And I think, you know, and as a babysitter, that's scary. I mean, especially like nowadays, so many kids have allergies and stuff. And I think, you know, and that's one reason why I put the, that's why I also based the book around the roles chart, because I don't think a lot of parents think about it when they go out there. You know, they quickly run out the door and they go, oh, by the way, you know, bedtime's at 8, and they can't watch this channel, and don't let them have any more sugar, and blah, 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 and then they walk out the door. But none of it's
right. Good luck, and God bless.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure, Chris, you can use that. It's like, you're leaving your kid. I know some people now, you know, there are 12 and 13-year-old babysitters.
Right.
And I think that's great. If they were my kid or a family member at that age, I'd probably let them be babysat by somebody else. But personally, I wouldn't go under 15. And even a 15, 16, 17-year-old, 18-year-old, you know, their brains are too much, you know, somewhere else half the time that you can't do it. And you have to write it down. You have to have a list of the rules down.
Yeah,
and
because kids are going to try to get away with that stuff too. At least my children do.
Yeah, and that's exactly what Sugar Paw does in the book. You know, he makes changes to his rules chart, you know, hoping to get rid of Bonnie. But I mean, so there's a lot that I put into the book, because you know I wanted kind of false rules in the reading. Like, oh yeah, you know, that's a good idea, a rules chart. You know, like maybe
right,
you think
right.
about that.
That is a good idea.
Like, I should have something written out for
right,
you know, on the do's and don'ts, because it is important, because they can't, they're not going to remember it all. And if they, you know, if they have like a big exam coming up, or, you know, prom night's right around the corner or something, their brain's off in La La Land and on their studies
sure.
or on their boyfriend or the next football game or whatever the heck's going on in the teenager's life, and especially girls, I'm sorry, most teenage girls are drama queens, and yeah. It's reality.
Yeah, Virginia, exactly. I know you do a lot with writing and things, but do you write for your personal writings almost every day, or does that kind of get pushed to the side, or?
You know, I used to be really good about that, and I used to be really good about writing every day. Even if it was like 30 minutes,
right.
I would write every day. And then as the magazine got really popular, First Trail magazine got really popular, it got less.
It sure.
was often like it did maybe a couple times a week, and then I think by the third year of publication, it was just, it had grown so much, and we had brought on, you know, I was fortunate to have on, you know, a lot of staff, which isn't even comparable to what we have now. I think at that time, I think we had like 10 to 12 people helping behind the scenes, and so my focus is on, you know, because everybody's a volunteer, you know, not like to stick pushy naggy boss, because I wasn't paying anybody, but, you know, just basically to make sure people are on track, or if their personal life
sure.
got involved that I could cover, or someone else could help cover, or whatever, just so things would run smoothly, which, you know, still don't always happen, because, like, our issue's not up right now. but, you know, trying
but
to
that's computer error, not human.
Yeah,
yeah, it sure
error,
is.
Human error. But, you know, so it, so, no, I didn't. And then when I got pregnant with my baby, I started writing again, started getting involved in a local critique group and was writing. And then, you know, I had my blog. And I was really thinking I was going to be really good about, I thought, blogging. Because sitting down actually writing a story out and really working on that, I just don't have time for. I have
right.
four manuscripts, like two YA manuscripts and two other picture books. Manuscripts. The two picture book ones are done, and they're in final revision. So they're just where I need to fine-tune them and send them out. But I have an outline of one YA book, and then I have 3 to 4 chapters of another one of a YA
wow.
book written out.
Wow.
And I'd love to get those finished. I don't have the time. So I thought blogging, you know, like, oh, like an online journal. That'll at least keep me actively writing and stuff. And, you know, I'm pretty bad about that as well. As well, it's hard. I think it's harder now that I have 3 kids, and we've grown Stories for Children so much. It's bigger. I mean, I'm now doing the blog talk radio shows, which I love doing. I don't want to say I don't write, because I do. I don't write children's stories or articles as much. I do write an article here and there. I actually have an article that I wrote for the back-to-school issue. So they will see something from me.
That's great.
That school issue as an article. So that's exciting. But I tend to write more articles as, you know, information articles for writers. And I do that because I have, you know, SSC newsletter for writers. So every month I have an article in there. And then I do quite a few articles for Halo that Lisa sends out to the Halo authors on marketing and that kind of stuff. But that's because it's so second nature. I can sit down and talk and write about marketing pretty easily anytime without having to put too much effort into it. It's a little different when you're developing characters or if you have
dialogue.
Like historical facts. Yeah, well, that dialogue comes pretty easy. But, like, you know, if you have historical facts or you're creating a theme and you need to, like, figure out, you know, you have to kind of do the world building and stuff, that takes way more time and sometimes research, and I just don't have the time. I keep telling myself, in 5 years, all my kids will be in school full time, and that's when I can really focus on that part of it because I'll have 6 hours a day with no kids in the house. So
uh-huh.
then I'll have more free time to focus on my children's writing. So I was good about it, and I get asked this a lot, and I've blogged about it, and I've written articles about it, you know, the whole button chair theory, you know, just put your butt in the chair, start writing, and next thing you know, you might make a goal write for 10 minutes, and the next thing you know, you write past 30 minutes, and then it's an hour, and I'm not disagreeing with that theory. I think it's a great theory, but there, no author writes the same. Some, you know, write in notebooks and are writing at red lights when they're carpooling their kids to the different functions or
yep,
sit in doctor's offices. Some authors can pull, and I know Irene knows the button chair theory because, you know, you do a lot with Suzanne Lawrence, and she's a big advocate on that, and I think it's great, and I know a lot of people who take her children's coaching course and sign up for the children's coaching. Is that what's called, the National Children's Coaching Center or National Children's
Writing
Center?
It's the National Writing for Children's Center, I think it is.
All right,
National
thank you.
Writing for
I guess
Children's
something
Center,
like that.
Yeah.
She has two of them, yeah, because she also is the Working Writers Coach, is the other one that she has.
Yeah.
And that's a great program. So if you are able to, in your life, be able to carve out your day and do that and sign up for Suzanne's, you know, groups that focus on that kind of thing, or do the ICL, which is Institute of Children and Literature, you know, any of their workshops, or I think their Savvy Writers is another one that kind of has that same button chair kind of theory. Great,
yeah.
Do it. I used to do it when I first was a writer. It's a great way to do it, and I totally agree. For me, I don't want to have people think I don't still focus on what I want to do, because I don't sit down, I don't type it out, I don't have notebooks full of notes anymore. I have a smartphone which has a voice recorder, but it's a voice-activated voice recorder. So when
uh-huh.
I click on that app, I'll just kind of start talking to myself, and people think I'm a little weird. So I have a bunch of ideas that I download from my phone into my computer. So when I'm
That's
able
great.
To, I'll sit down and start playing myself back at me, and then I'll write it. But sitting down actually writing doesn't happen. It's all voice right now.
I think that's probably the way it is for all writing mamas, isn't it? I mean, they
yeah.
have so much to juggle in a day, and there's, you know, children, and there's the dishes to wash and clothes to wash. So, you know, it's hard to just say, well, I'm going to write between 1 and 3 p.m., you know? It doesn't happen, does it?
Yeah, life doesn't happen, especially right now. You know, my baby, she just turned 15 months, and,
wow.
you know, it's... I'd love to say she's on a schedule, and, you know, God bless all the mothers who are able to get their kids on a schedule. My life isn't like that. I mean, we are, and I know you guys know, because I say this all the time to the SSC team, and I tell people who join our World of Ink tours and stuff, here's my office number. I route to my cell phone. You can pretty much call me 24/7. We don't sleep in my house. My husband, he sleeps in the morning, but he puts earplugs in because the kids are up. But my kids are up during the day, so I'm up during the day. And my husband's up usually till about 2, 3 in the morning, so I'm even up till about that time. So I'm usually up at least, you know, 18 to 20 hours straight every day.
So for
me to try and have a schedule, no, it doesn't work, because I have my kids on one schedule, my husband's on another, and I'm bouncing between both.
wow.
So my baby still that. So she sometimes she's good and she's on her brother and sister's schedule, and then other times she's on daddy's schedule and is up late at night with us. And
oh.
So I can't carve a writing time. That's why I've voice recording is what I do now.
Sure. Exactly. Oh, my goodness.
You kind of answered some of my other questions, was if you, like, had a notebook that you wrote things down or things like that, but you seem to kind of answer it in that one. I know you've talked to many writers, and can you, in a short version, I guess, so to speak, could you give us some of the best advice or some of the best tips that you've ever gotten, do you think? Or is that a loaded question?
It is kind of a loaded question, but I know we have to keep time short for you as well, Chris, because I know you have kids to go
sure.
with as well.
Yeah.
Because you're writing them off. We're all writing moms. We're all busy. And I know Irene takes on a lot of, I think it's your nieces and nephews, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yes, I've got 10
yeah,
of them at
so,
least.
So we all have kids always around us. You know, there's a lot of great advice out there. I mean, obviously, a lot of people, you know, butt and chair theory is one a lot of people get, you know, sit down and or carve out time, you know, or write when you can. You know, my advice is to kind of look at, don't honestly, the best advice, really, and this is my personal advice to everybody. It's not something I've ever been told from anybody. It's really my own personal take after all the different people I've met, because I do know a lot of authors and illustrators, and I know them from New York bestselling, you know, to novice just starting out. And the reality is, you can't compare yourself to anybody else. You can't in this industry. You may, you know, be a J.K. Rowling fan. You may be a James Patterson fan. You may be a Dr. Seuss fan, but the reality is everybody is very different. Their lives are very different. The way they write, the way they find time to write, the way they're inspired. If you try and mimic yourself after somebody else, you're actually going to hinder your creativity, because you're so focused, like, well, why am I not like them? Why am I not like them? Don't worry about it. Who cares? You know, if talking to yourself in the shower works, and everything's your crazy, it's fine. My son keeps telling me that he's going to have to lock me up in a straitjacket and put me in the padded room, because I sit here and talk to myself. And I will literally, you know, have a conversation with myself. And it's really myself having a conversation out loud with the character. And, you know, he thinks I have multiple personalities, which is probably true. And, you know, but that's what works for me. You know, sometimes I just break out in song and start singing, like, really weird songs and acting like a weirdo. And I think he thinks I'm having a mental breakdown. But, you know, hey, it's what works. It's what sparks
well, I
my
think
creativity.
Whatever works. Whatever works should be, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean,
we're too self-critical as writers. Sorry.
We are. And I'm not saying don't try other people's techniques. I mean, definitely try them out. See if they work for you. But if they don't get upset and say, oh, it means I'm not a good writer. It just, that one doesn't work. It's the same thing with, you know, marketing yourself or marketing your books. I mean, even if you're, you know, and for those who, you know, who are focusing on writing books, which I know a lot of people do, you know, I've talked to a lot of my friends who have books that have made it on the New York bestseller list and other ones haven't. And I've asked them, I said, well, what do you think it is? And I said, you know, the same marketing strategy, it doesn't matter. Even though it's me and people know my name, the same marketing strategy doesn't even work for each series of books I do. I have to revamp it every time.
Yeah.
So the rules never stay the same, even for yourself personally as a writer. So we can share different techniques with each other so you can try them out, but you really have to figure out which ones work for you, for your lifestyle, your personality, you know. It's really the truth. I mean, just for you and do what works for you. And it's really a catch-22 when success happens. You can't predict it. It's just if you're in the right spot at the right time in the right circumstances, you know, congratulations.
Right.
It's like
luck
runs there's a lot of luck that runs into it too, isn't there?
Oh yeah, I've literally have had people ask me, well, you know, you have to do research and you have to find the right publisher, and it doesn't matter if it's a magazine publisher for short stories and articles or if it's a book publisher, you know, from picture books to young adult novels. The reality is you can send it to an editor that you met at a conference, and they read it and they talk to him. They thought, oh, yeah, you know, definitely sounds like a great thing. You can read your mouth and say, you know what, just not for us. You could turn around 5 years later, send it to a totally different editor at the same publishing house, and they'll love it. And it just could be because it's 5 years later. It could just be because it's with a different editor. I mean, I see all the time hear stories for children, you know, stuff gets passed up the pipeline, and, you know, the assistant will love it, and then it'll get to the editor, and they'll reject it or ask for revisions. And then sometimes if it gets all the way up to me, you know, I'll have both of them saying, oh, this is so great. And then I'm like, what were you both thinking? I have to look at this. You know? I mean, that's why we have the three, you know, phases at Stories for Children, because every editor, and I kid you not, if you, and I tell and I tell the assistants, which, I mean, luckily, Irene, you haven't had to ask me lately, because I know I'm behind them since submissions and fiction. And last time, like, I have people asking, we're eight weeks past, you know, when we said you get back to these people. And I'm like, hey, you let them know, you know, I've had a lot of paperwork and stuff, and they don't want me, when I've been bogged down with paperwork, reading their stuff, because I'm going to be more critical and grouchy about what I'm reading if I feel overloaded than if I'm relaxed in reading. And there's a difference if I'm reading at 9 a.m. and when I'm reading at, like, 10 o'clock at night, and how I look at stuff. And I know that.
Sure.
I like to read stuff at every different time during the day so I get a better feel for the manuscript. I don't just read them once. I read them, like, three or four times. Because I know if I only read it once at a certain time, I'm going to make a decision based on, you know, my mood at that time. And that's just not the way to... And unfortunately, that's what a lot of editors do. And I just don't want to be like that. So,
so much of our life has to be, like, as writers, we have to always believe in ourselves first and foremost. And it seems like we want to sort of copy what everyone else is doing and not really developing our own ways and our own methods. And that kind of, that can hurt us in the long run, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And
it can.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to have to leave now, ladies. You guys can continue without me. It was great talking to you, Virginia. Thanks for your honest answers, and I will talk to you guys again soon.
Okay, Chris, take care of yourself.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah, it's quite a – what's that? I'm sorry, I thought you were saying something.
I was going to say, Chris, that's some really good questions. Okay, I'll keep it short. Yep, we're already half an hour into the show.
Yeah, I know. Well, that happens, you know. It's just such an interesting book that you have written. And, you know, I always like to ask a lot of questions that are background questions of writers, you know, like the psychology of writing and all that stuff, you know, about discipline and schedules. But I don't think there is such a thing when you're a writing mama, is there? You can't have writing schedules or discipline, for that matter. I guess the discipline that you would have would be discipline in action, right?
Yeah, that's really true, Irene, in that regard, because it's easy to, you know, and kind of like how Chris brought it up, you know, do you keep putting off? And, I mean, I won't kid you. I mean, have I put my writing off for writing for children? Yeah, I have, but I haven't put it off in the fact that I don't plan on getting back to it. And I haven't put it off in the fact that, you know, I'm not sitting down actually writing stuff down or jotting notes. I mean, I am recording thoughts and stuff. It's not like I've completely put it off. But the actual just kind of sitting down and typing out or working on actual manuscript, I have put off. It's a conscious effort that I've put it off. And I put it off with, you know, a timeline. I'm putting it off right now because right now I want to focus on Stories for Children magazine. I want to focus on... you know, Stories for Children publishing as a whole. I want to focus on, you know, the fact that we're doing the World of Ink tours for authors because, I mean, I know there's blog tours out there, but none of them really hone in just for children's writers like we do. So, I mean, that's kind of my focus is and spending time with my kids. I figure, you know, once they're in school for 6 hours a day, then I can, you know, have more of a you know, schedule and more of a discipline. I mean, my discipline more is making sure I sit down and make sure things are running, you know, that marketing's happening.
Oh, yeah.
So you're so disciplined, I think, as a mom, even though you don't have a schedule. I mean, you have to have the discipline, because otherwise, if you didn't, you
probably wouldn't get anything done,
Nothing would get done, but I think the discipline, how strong it is and how flexible it is depends on, I think, on each, you know, parent. And, I mean, I know... you know, a lot of men who are writers that, you know, go and work full-time and come home, and it's the whole, do I spend time with family or do I take, the, you know, these minutes before I go to bed and write? And they have to balance that as well. And I mean, it's definitely more on the women because the kids obviously will bug mom more than they'll go and bug dad when he's sitting down and writing. But I do know a few dads that, you know, it's still a balancing routine for them in many ways as well. And it's not easy. It's not easy, you know, especially when you have full-time jobs, like a lot of writers do, and a family to find time for writing. It makes it difficult, and unfortunately, a lot of people can't support themselves as a full-time writer.
Yeah, almost most people, eh?
Yeah, exactly. You really can't. I know very few people. I mean, I'm really blessed in the fact that I'm able to be home, and that my husband's able to cover, the household, things. But I don't want people to think that, I'm rolling in the dough. I'm not. I mean, what I do with my freelance side of it and working for Halo and stuff, I the only reason I started getting into that was because I wanted to, grow Stories for Children and make it bigger. So my whole freelance side actually goes right back into Stories for Children. And that's really why I do what I do. I don't really do it for the I did for a minute. I probably wouldn't do any Stories for Children because then I could focus on my novels. But, that's right. Kind of the thing. That's why I put my personal writing aside, because right now my goal is Stories for Children. And so I can't rob from Peter to pay Paul, and that basically is what would happen. So I had to make the hard choice. So, right now that's what my goals are. But, yeah, it is hard, and you do have to find some type of a discipline. Or it's always going to be the what if, or someday.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah.
It would be pretty tough to keep going sometimes and all of that. And so when it's, I say kudos to all the moms out there that are trying to balance all these things, including their writing. It's really, it's a tough slog and it's a tough go sometimes. It's really good that you guys are doing that. I know with myself, my writing day can be hectic too, but of course I don't have children directly. I have nephews and nieces that I, babysit quite a bit. And on those days, I start getting an inkling as to what it might be like, to have kids constantly. And my goodness, my writing is scattered and that to say the least.
Yeah.
So,
you're starting and stopping, and it's hard to... Especially it's so funny because I don't think sometimes family members get it until they're sitting there and they're typing an email to somebody, and you walk up and they're halfway in the middle of a thought that they're typing to an email to a friend or a family member, and they're kind of figuring out one minute, because my husband will do that. He'll come in, I'll be typing, and unfortunately, a lot of my writing is actually emails or writing media releases and stuff, which I focus on because I have to have a professional, error when I send stuff out. I can't send stuff out with grammar problems or typos because I just whip it out and don't read what I wrote, and my brain's everywhere, and so I just type whatever's going through my head, which would basically be a bunch of gibberish. And so I'll be focused on them. My kids will walk in, my husband will walk in, he'll ask me a question, I'll put my finger up, and he's just I have this really quick question. And so I'll finish the sentence, I'll tell him, you don't understand, I'm in a train of thought. And if you break it, I have to reread what I wrote, and it's one thing when it's email or media release, but when you're writing a story, the second you break that, it's broke, and it's really hard to get back into that groove.
And to feel
your muse going. So, it's not an easy thing.
Yeah, and it would be the same if you're writing the manuscript for the first time, or whether you're revising a manuscript. Would it be the same kind of real brokenness that you experience if you get disturbed?
Revisions, not so much. I lose my place because I have to reread where I was at so I can remember why I was revising what I was revising.
Right.
So it's more like refinding my place, Mark. But for a new manuscript, or even if I could send it first, early, 5-10 revisions that I'm working on, because you're still developing characters or plot lines or whatever.
Yeah.
It is. It's really hard.
Yeah.
And usually when that happens, I usually just shut my computer down or throw it in the drawer, whatever I'm doing, and just kind of say, I'm done with that now, because I have to wait until it hits me again.
Right.
I don't even try and get back into it, but it can be hard.
I bet. And what about your writing space? Is it, do you have a real, office, or do you just sort of... write whenever you can, wherever you can.
Well, I use a voice recorder for my writing right now. But when I do have a desk, I actually do have an office. We have we have actually a nice it's more like a den. Like when people have, like, you know, you have your formal living room and you have, like, a family room, and one's bigger than the other. So our den is the smaller of the two, and it's toward the back of the house, so I overlook the backyard.
Oh, nice.
And I have a nice big L-shaped desk, so I can scatter paperwork and contracts and books that get sent to us for review for Stories for Children, and all my personal books and all my computer supplies. Everything's just, like, all across this desk. And then what's nice is it's big enough to where my girls have some of their toys in here, and my kids have their computer in here, and then we have a TV and a futon and the Wii's in here. So when I'm working, the kids can actually be in here and watch TV or a movie or play a computer game or play on the Wii, and they don't feel like they're completely away from mom or mom's locked herself up in the office.
Right.
Which is nice. I'm very fortunate to have, you know, because I know a lot of people, it's like it's my laptop and it's wherever I'm sitting, or it's the kitchen table, or, you know, it's in my bed when the kids are asleep.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm really fortunate for that. This was supposed to be when we first moved into the house, and I hadn't started Stories for Children magazine. So originally it was supposed to be my husband's library is what we were going to convert it into. And then I kind of slowly have taken it over for the last 4 years. That's mine. He's like, that's your office. He doesn't even consider it even part of his anymore, even though he has, like, a whole wall of books in here.
That's cute.
We have wall-to-wall bookshelves in here with my husband's books, but that's about all that's in here, and a few of his, like, airplane photos that are his.
And does it have a door to it, too?
There's a door to the backyard,
yay.
And then there's a door that I can shut off the rest of the house.
Excellent.
As well, so, yeah. So when I have to, I shut the door.
That's great. Yeah, because I know that a lot of writers need relative quiet and peace when they're writing. So I know I do. I'm almost like I have to have a closed door and then some, like I have to be on the floor all by myself kind of when I'm creating for the first time, you know, like a new manuscript or whatever, and I'm planning.
Yeah.
So I guess it's not quite the same for you because you do have a little bit of noise in the background, but it is quite a bit the same, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, when I do sit down, which I'm going to actually be doing, I'm actually going to be dusting off one of my picture book manuscripts, like I said, that's almost ready to be submitted, because I'm like, I really need to get these out. They're not doing a good sitting in on my shelf, because they're actually on the shelf, sitting above me, staring at me, so I don't forget about them. But when I actually do sit down and work on a manuscript, I usually do it when all the kids are sitting. Minus my teenage son, when he's usually pretty good because he'll put his headphones on if he's playing like World of Warcraft or something, so I don't have to listen to his computer. But it's usually late at night. I find, and I don't know how it is for, again, like I said, it's different for everybody, but for me, I know, like, a lot of guys like, oh, I like to wake up and have my cup of coffee or my cup of tea or whatever it is, and sit down and write and be wide-eyed and write. I actually write better when I'm, like, half asleep and out of it, and my conscious mind can't focus because it's really my subconscious that writes.
That's interesting.
And my
conscious
mind gets in the way. So I tend to write in the wee hours of the night or the wee hours of the morning when you're, like, right on that verge of you could probably, like, fall asleep and not realize it. Because then I can just sit there and just let it go and just let it flow through me.
Yeah, that's
interesting. Well, it keeps me from trying to edit what I'm doing.
Yeah,
I just kind of type. My first draft, in every okay, you never submit your first draft because, well, it's pretty scary. Yeah, my first draft is usually a bunch of gibberish, but not really because I can find the story.
Yeah, you know what it is.
Yeah, and then I start weeding it out consciously later. But, I literally write when I'm half awake.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, a lot of writers are like that. You know, I've read a lot of biographies on writers about how they write, and a lot of them are writing after midnight, I find. When I've read a lot of different people that have done that, I sometimes do that myself. So I kind of know where you're coming from there.
Yeah,
like, it's quiet.
It's quiet and I think, you know, the biggest thing is, at least from what I know from a lot of my friends, is especially ones who tend to be very busy like myself, they'll tell me, well, I have a really hard time writing, because I have a, you know, what's the worst part of writing that you hate? Like, well, when I'm writing, I always, like, want to edit myself as I'm going. I just don't let myself write. you know, I'll write something and I'll, like, reread it. And that's the thing. That's why I do it when I'm, like, half awake, because I won't go back and reread it, because I'm, like, if I start reading it, then I'll fall asleep. So it keeps me from doing that. It keeps me from editing myself, which is what you need, because you don't need to worry about punctuation or correct sentence structures or any of that. That's what revision's about. You just want to get it out.
Exactly.
That's why I say it's gibberish. It's not gibberish in the fact you can't read, what the heck are you thinking? It's gibberish in the fact that I may have fragmented sentences, or I may have put in extra space or typoed a word because I didn't really care about spelling at the time because I was just writing.
Exactly. And you wanted that experience to be authentic, and I find that it's not for myself, at least. You know, if I'm trying to, you know, wonder, did I really get that down right? You know, is that really clear enough, et cetera, et cetera? Then I sort of get myself all bogged down in that detail, you know, and the authenticness of writing just goes out the door, you know. And so that's what I try to do, too, is just write fast, you know, whether I'm on a keyboard. And a lot of times I do it longhand, too. Do you do it longhand, too, or do you just do it on the computer mainly?
I do it on the computer mainly. If I really feel like I said, you know, I'm not a big outliner. I hate outlining. That's just not my thing. And if I do an outline, it's a loose outline. And I do them usually for nonfiction stuff, like articles or like a historical fiction type of, you know, short story that I may be doing. I don't do them for any of my picture books, manuscripts. I've never done one. But one of my YA novels, like I said, I have that one outlined. And the reason why I have it outlined is because it's definitely gonna be written to be a series. Write where the books can be a standalone. So if someone does ever decide to pick up when I finally write the dang thing, the book, and they don't want to, you know, they're like, oh, no, we only want to buy the one, we don't want to make this a series, then it can stand on its own. But if they want to make a series, it will be able to be that.
That's great.
And so that I have a loose outline, and I have to do that. And I've written some, like, scenes out in longhand only because it's world building. And so and it has to be a fantasy and paranormal activity, you know, are the two things I'm blending into the book. So when I do research, you know, I'll, like, read about, like, a paranormal type, you know, entity or something, or some, you know, Asian, because, you know, I don't want to stick to, like, one typical type of background for fantasy type characters, because, you know, there's so many different cultures out there. I mean, dragons are one. I mean, most people think of, when they see a dragon, they think of it, you know, it's the hard scales and the wings and you know, the claws and the sharp teeth and kind of that kind of dinosaur kind of looking kind of feel to it, like dinosaur lizard, you know, which is actually the European, you know, version of a dragon. But if you look at, like, a Japanese dragon or a Chinese dragon or a dragon from, like, the Philippines, those cultures are very different in how they show a dragon. Some have wings, some don't. Some look more like a serpent. You know, they're very different. Some have kind of like more of a lioness kind of look to them. So I'll go look at, you know, a lot of different cultures. You know, same with vampires, you know, and the type and how, and you know, vampires think of, you know, blood-sucking, you know, Dracula vampires, which, again, is a very European viewpoint of the vampire. If you look at a vampire, you know, from any of the Pacific Islands or, down toward Jamaica or, you know, somewhere like that, and their idea of a vampire and the different varieties of the vampires are very different. So with this way, but because it's kind of covering all of that kind of stuff, I have to write the scenes longhand because I'm usually at a library or I have, like, books out in front of me on a table, and so something will hit, and then all of a sudden I can see that character in the scene, and so I'm, you know, I write that out longhand. Mm-hmm. But typically, it's on the computer, and this is something I do, which it's kind of, I don't know if you ever want to try it or anybody else wants to try it, but when I'm writing a story, I actually turn my monitor off so I can't see it.
So that's great.
It's kind of like when you're, I mean, think of that. Those of us, you know, which, you know, when I learned to type, I didn't take typing class. I don't learn to type because I took a computer class. I learned to type because I was in a typing class on a typewriter. And when you're on a typewriter, you don't miss. You're not looking at the piece of paper you're typing on. You're typing. Yeah, you're either looking to the side because you're retyping somebody's notes, or, you know, typing class, it's usually like sentences that you're looking at as you're typing. So you're never looking straight ahead. So that's how I type. I type with the computer monitor off, so it's like I'm on the actual typewriter, so I can't see what's in front of me.
I think that's a great tip, because then you don't have to criticize yourself all the time, right? You can just look at it later.
That's exactly right. That's why I do it.
Yeah.
it keeps me from, again, self-editing as I'm writing.
Yeah, and I'm pretty awful about that too. So that's a great tip, I think, for everyone listening, because a lot of us are just so self-critical, and I think maybe writers are even the most self-critical about themselves. What do you think?
Yeah, I think we're our hardest critics. I think that's true with anybody who's in a creative type field. I think you're always going to be your own worst enemy, your hardest critic. I can guarantee you, I look back at stuff. I even look back at Baby Sunny Sugar Paw, and I can see where it could have been better.
I know.
And same here. And it's a great book. I mean, I love my book, but, looking back now after it's been printed stuff, I mean, I could have seen where I could have improved it, but that's just because it's me, and you can always, and I hear that from a lot of writers. Like, if you would have read my first book, and I'm talking usually like people like, have like 20, 30, 40 books under the belt. Like, they're like, man, I picked up the very first book I ever published. I'm like, and someone bought this?
Mm-hmm.
They bought this manuscript and decided to publish it? Like, what were they thinking? But that's because after 20, 30, 40 books, you've improved upon your own writing talent.
Mm-hmm.
So, it'll always be that way. And I can guarantee, once you're 100 books into writing, you're going to stop at, book 50 and say, what the heck was I thinking?
I find the same thing with my own books. I published, quite a few books in academia, and I know that, I look back at the first book and I'm going, did I really say that? Mm-hmm. And you're wondering sometimes, and of course you did. But it was, for myself, my first book was conceived about 18 years ago. So, that was a long time ago. So I have changed my views.
Your views changed. You've grown as a writer. You've learned new techniques. And writing changes. I mean, techniques are always changing.
Mm-hmm.
Even editing, I tell people that. I said, my favorite line is, and of course it's from Pirates of the Caribbean, but when I saw the very first movie, Pirates of the Caribbean movie, when they're talking about the pirate's coat, and it's when she gets, she's up on Barbossa's ship and, is doing the whole parlay. And she's like, wait, what about our bargain? And he's like, you didn't say anything about me, taking you back to shore. Don't have to. And she's like, well, what about the code? And he's like, they're more like guidelines. I'm like, oh my gosh, that is so true about writing. All these rules of writing, they're guidelines, people. You have to know when you can break them.
Yeah.
And to break
them
the correct way. Because it's really what it is.
Yeah.
So that was probably what that scriptwriter was thinking too when he wrote that line was, this is all guidelines and what I'm doing, because, it's going to change and everything else, because that's just what happens. I mean, even the rules of editing keep changing, so there's no rhyme and reason. So,
just
gotta do what you love.
Yeah, you have to do what works for you.
Yeah, I'm gonna wrap up this show for everybody because I actually ended up going the full hour, which I didn't think was gonna happen. But thank you, Irene. You and Chris both asked really great questions. It was definitely weird being flip flopped on the show today because I'm so used to having a guest in. And me going to town on our guest on questions with you guys, but I'm sure it was fun, kind of flipping the tables on me.
It was a lot of fun. I really learned so much about you, which was so wonderful.
Yeah,
and you're writing.
And we all work together. But I mean, you guys are so used to me sending emails like, "Where's this? What's that? What do you guys think of this?" So I know I don't really get a chance to really open up too much on my own personal level with you guys on my own writing. So it was nice sharing that with you guys.
That's wonderful.
and so our listeners know, this week on the World of Ink Network is actually a very busy week. We have shows every day this week. On Tuesday is a good story with host Marcia Cook. On Wednesday this week is Inspiration, Imagination, and Invention with Simon Rose. Then on Thursday we finally have our World of Ink guest Lucy Unina from last month able to join us. She's been having a very busy schedule, so we're excited that we were able to finally get a day and time that would work for her. So she will be on the show Thursday here with a special edition of Stories for Children. And we'll be talking with Lucy Unina about writing, being the founder and owner and editor of Halo Publishing, along with her Milo book series for children. And on Friday, you can catch me again on the Writing Mama Show, and we thank you for listening, and have a great day. Bye-bye.
Bye.
to the world of ink.